It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
In the next few days, it'll be the one-year anniversary of the white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, that took the life of Heather Heyer. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The sight of Nazi flags and the tiki torchlight march that reminded one of the 1930s Germany has now passed into history, but the alt-right is still here. Clashes at a recent rally in Portland, Oregon. There will be no march by them in Charlottesville this year, but alt-right leader Jason Kessler has vowed to press on with a rally in Washington, D.C. this Sunday to mark the anniversary. Take a look at where we are in our studio this morning. Kirkland Hall, the former president of a local NAACP branch, as well as now running as a candidate, a Democrat, for the delegate seat in Maryland's District 38A. And also Michelle Innes, with the Tri-Community Mediation here in Salisbury. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So first of all, I'll start with you, with Kirkland. What are your thoughts here on the anniversary of this event that took everyone by surprise, I think, in some fashion? And, of course, we had the president's response and everything that sort of followed from that. Where do you think we are a year from now?
Well, personally, I think the members or the organizers and individuals that participate in that event a little more emboldened now. I'm quite sure they're a little apprehensive a year ago how the public would respond. But once they got affirmative from the President of the United States, I'm quite sure they feel emboldened, just like many of others in this country, that they could do and say anything regardless of who it impact or who it hurt. And I think the level of what I want to say meanness, and I don't like to use this term hatred, that has permeated this country now, I think is escalating at a rapid pace.
Michelle, what are your thoughts a year out?
I agree, unfortunately, with Kirkland, and I think there's rising. I mean, I think there's a rising tide, and I don't think it's limited to the white supremacist movement. I think there's a rising tide of an unwillingness to stand it any longer. I think it's, if we look at a full spectrum, I think the polar ends of a spectrum, perhaps, who would be inclined towards coming to arms with one another are definitely increasing. I also think that folks in the middle who perhaps have the prerogative of remaining detached and somewhat oblivious are uncomfortable in ways that are now undeniable and really compelling us to ask tough questions about what then are we to do.
How did we get here? We went from the first African-American president to now Donald Trump, who clearly has appealed to the racial racist end of the political spectrum. What changed? And I mean, are we looking at simply that this feeling in this particular portion of the population has been there all the time and simply risen to the top, or at least to our public consciousness? Or is there something, do you think there's something more mobilizing going on that's growing rather than necessarily coming to the surface?
I think we have to go back a little further than President Barack Obama. If we go back to the Civil War, how families were divided, the North and the South. Then you fast forward to the civil rights movement, how a division, again, in this country. Then there was a Brown versus Board of Education back in 1954, where schools had to be integrated. And there were laws and policies forced on people. And even today, we have individuals still resentful that that happened. Then there was affirmative action. People felt that they were being pushed over, especially the white population, felt that they were giving away jobs and opportunities they felt that they were entitled to. Then President Barack Obama came aboard. Again, African-American president, the first one, and there was quite a few people, especially I think the older generation, that resented the fact that we had a black president. And there were some who said he was not our president. Now, fast forward to Donald Trump, who's bombastic, who would say anything, who would denigrate any people, especially women and people of color. You call them dumb, you call them low IQ. And those are code words that some people just rallied to. And now, as Michelle just mentioned, I'm afraid that there's going to be some violence because there are people that are resistant feel that the government is not helping them. They have to take actions in their own hands, and that's what I'm worried about, especially this Sunday.
Michelle, I ran across a phrase which I was taken by the other night, which is that equality to privilege feels like oppression. And I might maybe add that maybe perhaps unconscious privilege, perhaps. You think that's part of the problem? That those who are more privileged in society, certainly the white end of the spectrum, nonetheless do not feel privileged? I mean, if you're a working guy and you're struggling along, you certainly don't feel privileged. What about that dynamic, that somebody is not conscious of what's going on the other side?
I think that the language that we use, and certainly terms like privilege, that resonate so deeply with some people and really speak to the experience of hopelessness. And for others, it becomes such a buzzword of feeling radically, wildly misunderstood, where people say, but I'm a good person and I'm not, or I grew up poor. Mm-hmm. There's so many challenges in terms of the language that we utilize right now on social media, in media, mm-hmm. in general, in conversation, where we tend to, from keyboards, hurl our thoughts at one another or our positions at one another, or when we have conversation, it's with like-minded individuals. And really, part of what I think is that equality, privilege, all of those terms, we've been working for 2 years now on community conversations on race, bringing together, I mean, it's small, 20 people at a time. We're on our fifth group where people are talking about their own experiences and awareness of race, and then slowly coming into larger conversations. It's probably not till the fourth or fifth session that we bring up a term like privilege, because we're trying to really allow space for people to have deep understanding. And I think that there's so much to it. There's so much to it for everyone. And my only sense of how we're going to move forward is if there gets to be some level of shared understanding of where people are coming from.
Do you think, Michelle, do you think that the onset of social media in particular, and its anonymity for that matter, do you think that's intensified this divide or this distance? Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the very project I was just talking about, Community Conversations on Race, curiously came about in response to a Facebook Live post. To like a rant, a sorry, not sorry kind of a piece, mm-hmm. and then someone from the media reaching out. So I also think that social media can be, I've had people say things, post things, and I've said, this isn't the kind of conversation that I'm going to entertain in this forum, but if you'd like to sit down and get together, I think we have to take responsibility for our communication and the kind of conversations we host and ask ourselves, what are the outcomes we're hoping to achieve? Are we trying to be the big person, splattering it, getting the most likes, or are we trying to really create a shared understanding?
Speaking of new media, one of the things that strikes me is the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement. And in part, it seems to me, has been sparked by our ability to now see in real time incidents involving the police and African Americans on film, and we can now draw our own conclusions, as opposed to something being sort of filed out into like a police report, and nobody really knows what's going on. Do you think technology is pulling, making this issue much more aware in terms of the national consciousness?
Definitely so. I think what has happened because of the called the age of technology, social media, more people are aware of what's happening. You could tell someone something, and they may be reluctant to believe what you said. But even when people see things, sometimes subconsciously we see things the way we perceive it to be, and does not necessarily have to be that way, because we're looking at it out of our own spectrum. But I think because of that, and Black Lives Matter and the Me Too movement and all those the movements that is going on in this country. And because of the media, more and more people are finding out the actual, what is actually going on in this country. And more people are getting involved. Even just I'm running for House of Delegates, as you mentioned earlier. Right. We have a messaging some nights, and three or four of us get on the telephone and well, cell phone, not telephone, and talk about different things. We can also face, what's called Facebook, and Facebook people, and then you got Facebook, and there's so many ways to get information out. And because of that, more and more people are getting on board to the causes that they believe in. And I think that is causing some degree of difficulty because we've got to be open-minded. And Michelle mentioned the word conversation. We have all got to have that difficult conversation, express our feelings, but we've got to come to some type of understanding if we're ever going to change anything in this country. If we're constantly button heads, there's always going to be controversy, there's going to be conflict, and no one's going to come to an agreement on basically any issue.
And I think it's, if I might add to that, I think it's not just having conversation, difficult conversations. Mm-hmm. I do believe that. I think it's checking ourselves and creating a different level of self-awareness. If we are only talking with the folks who are nodding in agreement with us, there is an inherent danger in that, living in these silos. When we look at this country, when you travel and see there's certain areas, and even in this community right now, mm-hmm. and you look at how racially divided neighborhoods are in our community. Names of streets that people of one race know and another do not even know exist.
Absolutely.
There are, unless there is this coming together, we only move out of polarity and being able to label one another when we become human to one another. And if we're not having conversation with one another and really sharing in one another's everydayness, we lose that opportunity.
Well, one of the flashpoints, it seems to me, over the last few years has been, of course, Confederate monuments, statues, and so on and so forth. Here in Salisbury, of course, we've had a great battle over the Confederate general who was memorialized on a plaque. He apparently was actually involved in overseeing the prisons that held Union prisoners. But we also had the Talbot Boys, for instance, a statue there, which there was controversy. That one stayed well. What do you think that symbolizes, Kirkland? What do you think that symbolizes in terms of the kind of division that we see? I mean, I've talked to actually a couple of people who supported the idea of having the Talbot Boys, the sign, and you know, they say, you know, they don't want us to take away their history. That there's this polarizing sense about it. Does that symbolize the kind of divide you think that exists in this kind of community?
I think it definitely symbolizes the divide, but also what has happened, we pick and choose who we want to immortalize. Civil War, 1865, and allegedly, I guess unless I have been misled, the North won that battle. So therefore, if the North won, to the victor gets the spoils. But we tend, especially on the shore, immortalize more of the Confederacy as opposed to Northern monuments. Now, if you can help me name me a monument that immortalizes the Northern victors in this area, then I like to see it. But what has happened, the most heinous crimes you can think of, this wonder, prison
coming,
all those people that died, but yet he becomes a hero. And then I'm finding there were a number of Northern soldiers who lived for years in this community, and most of us don't know about them. There's no monument to with a listing of their names so that people can be educated that they participated in the Civil War. So again, we pick and choose who want to immortalize. We pick and choose because it satisfies our own. It's a self-gratification that we get and feel that since that plaque is there, one side think they won. Now the other side is trying to come up with methods and ways to convince them that the sign should not be there. It should be somewhere else. It should be in a museum, which I've stated on numerous occasions. I love museums. There's no problem having it in a museum, but I don't think it should be on public display.
Michelle?
We facilitated some conversations on these subjects and with a lot of variety of possible solutions of movement of monuments, of adding additional monuments. And part of what I think has been interesting and noteworthy is the timing of when monuments were placed. And we ask ourselves with any action, what's the outcome folks are hoping to achieve and why in particular moments? And so as the civil rights movement increased and gained traction, many Confederate monuments began to appear. And it seemed to be, and I think that that's lost on many folks. So there's an additional piece of context. And I've heard folks and supported folks trying to express the importance of history, lest we forget, lest it be repeated. And then I've also gained an appreciation for having a full-bodied context. Like I've heard variety of possible solutions. You want to have the monuments there put up when it was erected, and perhaps why. Mm-hmm. Put up additional monuments for people who, like the full story, and the full piece, even when you were talking about technology and policing, and is it helping to increase awareness? Perhaps, but unless we together are processing how that what's happening, we can all look at the same piece of footage and see something different, and it can validate our positions. Unless we're engaging with folks and creating a balanced and shared perception, we're not really going to walk away with a full or a complete understanding. I think the same is true with Confederate monuments. Is it creating a full and accurate understanding?
Well, because one of the things you mentioned a moment ago about when these things were put up, a number of them were actually put up during the 1920s and 19-teens, which was a height of the Ku Klux Klan, and was a lot of it was commemoration 50 years after the Civil War and so on and so forth, a much different period in which white supremacists, particularly outright, was being celebrated, certainly in the South and here. So the question becomes, if you try to play, say, give a fuller understanding of who, how these monuments were put up, you're going to wind up telling somebody that, you know, this was put up in support of the Ku Klux Klan. Are you a Klan supporter? I mean, that forces somebody to come to grips with a history that maybe they don't want to come to grips with, Michelle.
I don't think anyone's ever accused me of trying to make it too tidy or candy coating. I think that if we end up providing more information with which to wrestle, it's going to be appropriate, and it probably isn't going to kill us. Probably the only thing that will kill us is what actually does. And I would say there's a far greater danger in our continued ignorance as we're watching things escalate, and as unfortunately things may play out this weekend.
I think I recall reading that it was a group called the Daughters of Confederacy. I think that was a group who really galvanized this particular activity. And it was also used by others as a method of fear mongering with the Klan, who was at its peak during that particular time. You recall they marched on Washington, D.C., and thousands upon thousands marched on Washington, D.C. And again, because individuals knew about the history and knew why the Klan was organized, and now you got the Klan, now you got the monuments and all this other stuff, plaques and monuments and statues coming up. It's a measure of fear, and also it's a method of not forgetting. And who's it benefiting? Those who side with the Confederacy feel that the war's still going on, and people's minds, individual minds, is still going on.
Let me say this, Kurt. So one of the things that strikes me is that we certainly have a new awareness about racism and our past. That's certainly one of the things we're coming to grips with in terms of the Confederate statues. And that this awareness, which has now come to the surface, is coming into conflict with the past. People who identify, whether it's with the Confederacy or just white privilege or whatever it happens to be, that we see a couple of great tectonic plates, as it were, in terms of demographics. We all know that by 2040, whites will be, no one will be a majority anymore. Do you think that's part of what we're looking at in terms of this sort of almost whiplash between Barack Obama on the one hand and then Donald Trump on the other? I mean, do you think that's as part of this process that can work itself out?
I mentioned a couple of terms earlier, fear, and also entitlement. You mentioned 2040. Mm-hmm. Most researchers say that the demographics of this country will be the minority will be in the majority. There are individuals who are afraid of that change and ask themselves, what does that mean for me and my family? For instance, on Fox News, the lady Laura Ingraham, the statement that she made yesterday about this country is not the country that we're proud of and will remain proud of based on the changes. And she named a couple of cities that had changed dramatically over the years. To me, as a human being, a person that grew up during the Jim Crow era, a person that experienced riding on the black school, going to a black high school, had to walk on one side of the street, couldn't drink any water fountain, had to sit up in the balcony of the movie theater, had to go to the back for a sandwich. But still, there's no hate in my heart. I look at that as a sign of the times. And as you continue to grow and mature, I teach my kids and let them know that times are changing. And we got to prepare ourselves for the changes. We can't control it. I don't think we need to control who comes in this country. I'm a firm believer that getting back into content history of it. People come for various reasons. And I'm a firm believer. That's why I went to school. That's why I studied. Because I don't want to do the job that I did as a youth, working in the fields, day in and day out for peanuts. That's why I work so hard in high school. That's why I work hard in grad school. That's why I'm constantly learning. But we got to teach everyone that no one can take something from you. You got to earn what we get. So there's no such thing as entitlement anymore. That shouldn't be. If Michelle and I were competing for the same job, the best person should get the job. Not because she's a female, not because I'm African-American male. It's because who's better qualified, who can do that job better. And of course, I know she do a job a lot better than I do, so I want to apply.
Or we could revamp the system. We could be co-directors and whatever. Yeah, perhaps we could just restructure it and start to question some of our systems, designs, and assumptions we make.
Okay. Mm. Well, Michelle, it does seem to me that I mean, a lot of the focus has now been on immigrants. First, it was undocumented immigrants. Now, we had Laura Ingraham talking about illegal immigration and so on. How do you deal with the idea that some people look at immigrants in general as a threat? I mean, in fact, I did a piece, I don't know, a number of years back, and I talked to people in the African American community, and one of the things I can't remember who it was who said from the NAACP, and said, "Well, you know, my heart goes out to these immigrants, but you're killing me because you're taking my jobs." You know, that's I mean. How does one deal with that fear that people have, that somehow something's being taken away from them, whether it's immigration or it's affirmative action for that matter? A tough question. I keep coming back
to the community conversations on race that we've been having, where folks are saying we need to expand this group. So we've had folks from the Haitian community really needing to have an increase in terms of Latino, Hispanic members of our community as a participants. And part of it is about, I think part of it is about when there's a fear about limited resources and the way that we even view our approach. And I think that it's very easy for us to succumb to the labels. And it's exactly like Kirkland was talking about, this piece of when we were talking about the language that we use and how we approach. I mean, I think that I personally tend to believe that I didn't deserve to be born with any particular citizenship. It happened. Mm-hmm. And I don't know of any of us, when we trace it back,
all immigrants.
Who would have been here, right, otherwise. And I think where we are now in these times, it requires all of the pieces. It requires sound, thoughtful, and just legislation. It also, in the day-to-day, requires us showing up in our humanity. Even when I think about the social media conversations we talked about, police footage that we talked about, I mean, all of these pieces, we seem to bypass anything that's sacred. We seem to bypass our humanity. Mm-hmm. Like we're looking through it in this binary fashion for like playing a blame game rather than recognizing trauma, like someone's brother, father, sister, mother. Like I don't know how it is we're compartmentalizing those pieces. And I feel like that needs to be integrated. I think we need to look at resource management, assuredly. Mm-hmm. I think that in any of us in our lives, but we need to balance it with our humanity and recognize that people are sacred.
Finally, just a minute we have left. Kirkland, are you optimistic we're going to get through this period?
Yeah. Can I go back to one other thing you mentioned about you talked to NAACP president who said that immigrants are coming and taking our jobs.
Right, that was the feeling he had.
I would ask that individual, as a former NAACP president, what jobs are they taking that you feel you want? Look at the farmers in this country today who are suffering because of having people to work in the fields. Look at individuals in the seafood industry that are on the verge of closing down because they don't have help. So I'm trying to understand what job is it that they're taking that they want. Look at our medical profession. How many immigrants that are medical doctors that may save our lives, may save your lives. So it all depends on what profession you choose. Now, if they want to go back to where it was back in the 60s when we had working fields, well and good. But we need those work. I love fruit.
Right, but you're not going to go on the field to pick it, however.
Unless perhaps we pay people differently in the laborers.
$15 an hour.
We've been talking with Kirkland Hall. He's the former president of the local NAACP chapter. Also, he's a Democratic candidate for delegate seat in Maryland's District 38A. Also, Michelle Innes. She's executive director of the Tri-Community Mediation here in Salisbury. Appreciate you taking the time to stop by and chat with us.
Thank you. Good morning.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. We're all aware of the stories about Harriet Tubman and the Underground Railroad, but maybe not about the places that shaped life in those times. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. We often pass by those sites as we drive through Delmarva without even imagining what they may have been like in the mid-1800s as the nation moved closer to the Civil War. Jim Duffy has authored a new book about those sites entitled 32 Underground Railroad Journeys on Delmarva, Tubman Travels. In the book, he takes us through the stories and the sites that make up that era. We have him in the studio this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me, Don.
So tell me then a little bit about what was the inspiration for doing this during this book?
My inspiration for doing this book is really related to a guy who passed away a couple of years ago. John Creighton was a historian based in Dorchester County, kind of a self-trained historian who really did a lot of the foundational work for turning the story of Harriet Tubman from the myths that had passed through time into facts based on actual research. And I got to know John after moving to Cambridge in 2004. I was part of his monthly Harriet Tubman discussion group for a long time and things like that. And as I looked for a second book project to take on, this just kept kind of coming to the surface for a lot of reasons that I'm sure we'll discuss as we continue forward.
Were you, before you did this book, were you aware physically of all the places, or was that a discovery process?
I was. There's one particularly memorable moment that I talk about in the book where John and his partner Pat Lewis and I and a group of other people all got in the car after one of these discussion group meetings and went down into South Dorchester County and ended up on Harrisville Road, which is a two-lane road that goes to a one-lane road that goes to a dirt road and then goes for a long, long way. And that, at the end of that dirt road, is where historians currently believe that the cabin where Harriet Tubman was born is. And that's one of the interesting things about these sites is some of them are a little bit out of the way, and some of them, most of them, in fact, are kind of unlike traditional travel destinations. It's not like going to Monticello or something like that where you're putting your hands on things, because all these slave cabins are gone and people don't precisely know which route people took. And it's more about looking out at a landscape and, I think you used the word in your introduction, imagining what went there. And that's what my book, Tubman Travels, is really all about, is helping people look out at for many of us, a familiar landscape, and seeing it in a new way that really reflects what was going on in the 1850s.
You begin with actually an extensive discussion of the Middle Passage and where the boat that brought the first, I guess, relative for Harriet Tubman to the shore. Tell us a little bit about that. And why did you emphasize that particular Middle Passage? Because there's a lot of description about on the way, not just where you were. And, yeah. And where did it dock?
Harriet Tubman was third generation here. Her grandmother came here aboard a slave ship. And it's very difficult to sort of track exactly where that slave ship went. In all likelihood, it came up the Choptank River. It's possible that it turned and went to Oxford. They had a good number of slave sales there. Cambridge had a few less slave sales here. What I talk about in that chapter is just how sort of, it's one thing to talk about sailing across the ocean, but the conditions on these ships were just unfathomable. And I thought that's actually chapter one in the book, and I have you on a lighthouse on the Choptank River looking upriver and trying to imagine that ship coming in. Another reason to emphasize that is the fact that she's third generation. Frederick Douglass, another famous Delmarva person, is fifth generation, actually, on Delmarva. And I think that that was one of the things I learned in the book, was I came into the book somehow in my mind thinking of white families and white people as being established and kind of rooted here, while the black people were sort of newcomers and transplants. And that actually turned out often not to be the case. In fact, Harriet Tubman has a very famous quote about, you know, there was a movement to kind of ship blacks, free blacks, back to Africa. At one point, the colonization movement, it was called, and she was very much opposed to that. And her quote is, "We're rooted here, and they can't pull us up." And that was sort of the inspiration, I think, for positioning that Middle Passage journey by her grandmother in the very first chapter of the book.
So give us a sense about where she certainly was born, but where she lived, and particularly in terms of the landscape and where people were at that point.
Yeah. So I mentioned Harrisville Road. Her father was owned by a guy who was doing a lot of forestry work down there. Now, Harrisville Road, if people are familiar with South Dorchester, is kind of on the way to Taylor's Island. And Wolford General Store it's in that area way back in the forest. Her family for the first 8-ish years of her life was completely intact. A large family, a number of kids, 7 kids, I think it was. And the two parents were all together. That was all torn apart when she was 8 years old. Complicated estate situation. Her owner turned 21 and took control of her mother and the children, while the father was retained under his owner. And so he pulled that family away to a town of Bucktown, again, in South Dorchester, maybe 5 or 6 miles away. There's a plantation there that you can kind of look over an old plantation house that's associated with her. There's also the Bucktown General Store. There is an old 1850s, 1860s general store building where a very important thing happened in her life. And that 3 of her sisters during this period were sold off into slavery, and she was pulled away from her father. And there's one historian who's sort of Jean Humez is her name, who positions this as the real defining moment in her life, that she was the Humpty Dumpty child who kind of spent the rest of her life trying to put her family back together again after enduring this at the age of 8 or 9, and most, in fact, of her trips back from the North much later in life. Were attempts to rescue her family members, and other people would kind of pop up, or she wouldn't be able to find the family member, and she'd pick up other people. But family was her motivation throughout her life.
So, as a matter of fact, we alluded to, there was the incident in the village store. Describe for me that particular incident, where it was, and if we go there now, what do we see?
Yeah. You see a store building, kind of a large one-room store building, that is very much like what would have been there on the day that young Harriet Tubman came to visit. The building is either the original building or it's a building built on the precise same foundation. And it is, I mentioned earlier about imagining and not being like Monticello. This is one of the one places where you can genuinely feel like you're walking in her footsteps, for sure. It's that sort of a building. This was the site of her first known act of defiance. She ran an errand to the store from the nearby plantation where she was living. And she got caught in the middle of a situation. And a slave overseer was chasing a young enslaved boy and ordered Harriet Tubman to stop that boy. And she flat out refused. That overseer then threw a 2-pound hardware store kind of weight at the boy, missed him, hit Harriet Tubman in the head. And very nearly killed her. She was working on flax at that time, and I'm not real familiar with that, but apparently it's really dirty work, and she was really self-conscious about the way that her hair looked. So she was wearing kind of a turban over her head. And she always said, I think it's that there scarf saved my life. She spent a year, perhaps even more, in recovery, lost a lot of weight. She was already small-statured. And the historian Kate Clifford Larson has done a great detective work. So for most of the rest of her life, Tubman experienced visions, heard voices, and succumbed to episodes of narcolepsy, suddenly falling asleep. And that hit on the head she took is consistent with temporal lobe epilepsy, which would be a physical disease that manifests itself in exactly those things, visions and voices and sleeping episodes. And what makes the story especially interesting in the end is that through most of her adult life, this woman of incredible faith took those voices and those visions and the dream she had during those sleeping episodes to be direct communication from God. And heeding those messages and interpreting them in her own way and following them basically always worked out perfectly for her, which is why I title the chapter about this episode, God Works in Mysterious Ways.
Now, she begins to, of course, she decides to make her first foray out of slavery, that is to escape. Tell us a little bit about that, and where would that be located?
Yeah, she was living in Caroline County at that time, probably very near a cabin, one-room cabin that her parents had on a place called Poplar Neck, which is below Preston, very near the small waterfront town of Choptank. She was married at this point to a guy named John Tubman. Her owner had died. And there was great fear that in the process of the estate, they were going to unload some property, including her and perhaps her brothers. What I got into in more depth than I had perhaps when I started the book coming into is the fact that there was a first failed escape in which she got two of her brothers and they went off on their own. And the brothers got very scared. And the brothers kind of forced her to turn back. And that's very interesting to me because you can look at that as, oh, her brothers were kind of chicken or didn't have the courage that she had. But it's also the way I kind of grew to look at it is she wasn't ready to escape at that point. She had no connections on the Underground Railroad. She just packed up and left out of the blue with those two brothers. And they're wandering around the landscape they know nothing about. They don't have any station they're going to. They don't have anything. And that turning around and coming back the next time when she did successfully escape, she did so with the help of a nearby Quaker woman who connected her with the Underground Railroad. And her journey is a bit of a mystery. She went from station to station, but it's not clear which house and which river and what all went down. And when she got across, almost the first thought, as she recalled it later in life, the first thought she had was, was I'm free, and now my family needs to be free.
By the way, what would that have been like for her to make that trip? Because obviously she's making it, well, I assume certainly in large part on foot. We know that they were transported on the Underground Railroad through wagons every once in a while, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What would that have been? She would travel at night? If so, what would that landscape have looked like?
Yeah, that...
That's pretty daunting.
It is very daunting. And I have some. One of the things I do in the book is try to get voices from the period into the book from old slave narratives, including escape narratives. And there's some horrifying things about being tracked down by dogs, experiencing really horrible weather, not even knowing where this thing called Pennsylvania is. And you're in most cases, the guess among historians is that they kind of followed riverbanks, stayed away from towns. But there are also exceptions to that. I mean, there was one escape involving Seaford, Delaware, where she took a steamship from Baltimore down to the Nanticoke River and up to Seaford because she didn't have the right paperwork to go directly from Baltimore to. So it varied greatly, but without a doubt, it was a terrifying prospect at almost every turn.
Well, you mentioned the steamboat. What seems to me, and I think you say this in the book itself, is that all the kind of various tricks and quickness of mind that she had in order to get past everyone, discovered that force. That was fascinating.
There were some incredible tricks. You could just kind of tick them off. So that was one. She didn't have the proper paperwork to go to bring a woman named Tilly to the north. So instead, in order to escape slavery, she actually went south, because she didn't need the paperwork to go south, and got off somewhere in the south where she was able to connect with her Underground Railroad connections. There was an incident where she was walking through town disguised. Disguised is one continuous theme, disguised as an old lady who had a couple of chickens with her when she saw a white man who was either his master or an overseer or whatever threatening prospect might have been in front of her. And she basically kicked the chickens and went chasing after him, and the chickens are squawking and her head's down and everybody's laughing at this little old lady running through town, and the guy just walked right by. And there's another incident on a train in which she picked up, somehow she had a book with her, and she picked up the book because she had seen somebody else who might know her, and that person would immediately know that she didn't know how to read. And so she picked up the book in order to try to demonstrate that she could read, and she recounted later that she was just praying the book was upside down, upside instead of upside down, or whatever it was. So there's a million tricks like that in the book, and then there's also times when she's kind of out of tricks, and all she does, there's two particular, maybe three occasions in the book where she's completely out of tricks. She has nothing. She is trapped, and she gets down on her knees and prays, and once again, that works out pretty well for her.
So she does, initially she does get to the north, I think it was to Baltimore, is it? And she finds, obviously, that she's happy about freedom, but then there's another emotion that sets in, and something that's actually reflected, I think, also in Frederick Douglass as well.
Yes, the contrast between Douglass and Tubman is really interesting. I mentioned that Tubman's family was intact and then ripped apart. Douglass was kind of the reverse. His family was never intact at all. He barely knew his mother, barely knew his siblings, and had a completely broken family situation. When she got to the North, I'm trying to remember the precise phrase that she used, because it's so appropriately for someone at the bottom of society, of American society, and that's, she sort of channels Patrick Henry, and her quote is, I could have two things, I could have liberty or I could have death, and I'm determined to have one of them. And that was how she reflected on her journey. And then again, we get back to the family issue, because that was the primary thing that she became much of her life's mission during the 1850s after her escape, was bringing her entire family up north. And she very nearly succeeded in bringing everyone One sister tragically died before Tubman got a chance to bring her up.
I mean, the thing I think about is that she expressed it, that she was realized that she was alone. There was a certain loneliness that took place.
Yes, thank you.
And Douglas expresses something similar in the sense of no connection. Yeah, tell us a little bit about
that. A whole bunch of the slaves. The book includes not just Tubman and Douglas, but a number of other stories. And that is one of the terrifying prospects of going on the Underground Railroad is you are going someplace where you know no one. You're going someplace where you've heard legends that there may be people to help you, but you don't have any idea whether they are true. And you're going someplace where all the bonds of family, spouse, and love, and friends, you are walking away from all those things. Now, I came away from this book, one of the sort of surprise, revelations, let's say, to me, was just how hard that decision could be. There are stories in the book of people who leave their children behind, much less their parents and their siblings. And that heading out away from all of those bonds of family was a really terrifying prospect. I ended up with a great respect and admiration, not just for the people brave enough to go, but also for the people brave enough to stay, if that makes any sense. I don't think there was a right decision. I don't think there was a wrong decision. It's beyond a catch-22. Some people decided to stay and maintain those bonds of family and friendship, even when they had the opportunity to escape. The sister that I mentioned who died was one of those. She made that choice a couple of different times, declining to join Harriet Tubman on the trip north because she was unable in that given moment to collect her children and bring them with her.
One of the things that she has in common with Frederick Douglass is that Douglass seems to be, at various points in his life, very rebellious in the sense of rejecting authority. And then at one point he's beaten down, but then he comes back and he strikes. I think he actually strikes one of his overseer, if not the master. Mm-hmm. Where do you think that comes from? I mean, if you're in such an oppressive state, I mean, it's where everybody else controls everything and very violently controls everything. So it's not just being told. And yet you find people like Douglass or Tubman, with her incident in the store, just snatching that one moment.
It's incredible. Again, you know, it's kind of like these stories, because they are set during slavery and slavery is at the heart of the stories, they, for all the obvious reasons, reflect the very worst of America. But in the way that you're talking about here, they also reflect the very sort of best of American values and traditions. And I mentioned the one with Harriet Tubman and the liberty or death quote about kind of channels Patrick Henry. But Douglass and Tubman, for her matter, do the same thing with that kind of Horatio Alger, pull yourself up by your bootstraps business. Douglass had a very freewheeling childhood along Tuckahoe Creek in Talbot County. And he lived with his grandmother and grandfather. His mother was generally out of the picture. And he has really genuinely fond memories of the first 6 years of his life in slavery. You'd think that would be starting at the bottom, but in his mind, it was kind of starting at the top of life's roller coaster, if you will. The secret to where that pull yourself up from the bootstraps sort of miracle comes from is just a mystery. How do the people at the very, very, very bottom of society still, those values somehow trickle down to them even through all of the oppression and violence they face? Douglass basically taught himself to read as a young boy. He had a white woman in Baltimore who taught him the letters of the alphabet, and then that woman's husband found out what he was doing and put a stop to it. And he took that basic knowledge of the letters of the alphabet and turned it into reading Greek and Roman oratory as a young teenager over the matter of a couple of years. He did it by himself. I don't know that there's a greater pull yourself up by your bootstrap story than Frederick Douglass in kind of all the annals of American history. I really don't.
You mentioned, by the way, in the books, as a matter of fact, he wrote, I guess three biographies, and you mentioned that his view of his time in slavery, and particularly his former master, that they seem to soften. Matter of fact, he even visits, I think, at one point after the Civil War, his former master. Tell us about that journey that you did. Because most of us, well, we wanted the other, but he went out looking at all three of them. You know?
Harry Tubman never came back to Maryland, as far as anyone knows. Douglas came back on a number of times. So he wrote three separate versions of his autobiography. And as I'm sure most people listening know, he was easily the most famous black man of his time and one of the most famous men of his time for his accomplishments in the abolitionist movement as a speaker and writer. He famously wrote, I think it was in the 1840s, he wrote a letter to a slave master, which was addressed to his former owner, and basically said, I'm going to use you as a weapon in the fight against this horrible evil. I don't know if he actually postmarked it to his owner. I do know he published it in newspapers all over the North. And he did do that. And he was really successful. And there's no doubt but that he was on the right side of history in that fight. But as he got older, he started to wonder if maybe he had taken things a little bit too far. And one particular occasion involves his former master's treatment of his grandmother. Now, she did not end up in some fancy assisted living facility like we have today. But by the standards of the time, she was treated decently. By the standards of the time, I can hasten to add. But in his first version of his autobiography, Douglas had accused his master of mistreating his grandmother and leaving her out in the cold when she was no longer able to work. And in his second autobiography, he toned that down a little bit. And in his third autobiography, he basically didn't make that accusation at all. And when he got word as an old man that his former master was about to die, he decided, incredibly to me, that he needed to go down to St. Michael's to apologize to him for making that false accusation. And he took a steamship from Baltimore. He had the media was in tow with him. He's a very, very famous man and went into a B&B, what is now a B&B on Cherry Street in St. Michael's, and did indeed apologize to his former master. They had other parts of the great conversation. He got actually in all kinds of trouble for that. There was a cartoon that ran in newspapers all over the South of Frederick Douglass, the great Frederick Douglass, on his knees begging the forgiveness of his former master. The New York Times editorialized that Frederick Douglass's time as a leader of his race is about played out. And to Douglass's credit, in my mind, he kind of dismissed all that as so much media background noise. And I think when I got to a point in the book when I was kind of done reading about Frederick Douglass and needed to start writing about it, I remember turning to my wife and just sort of shaking my head and going, what a decent man. I mean, to have fought the good fight and have done all the great things that he did, and then at the end of his life say, you know, I really got to go back and apologize to that SOP. is just sort of an incredible decision and reflects the basic decency of the man.
What was the relationship between Tubman and Frederick Douglass?
There was no relationship that is known while they were on the Eastern Shore. In the North, they became acquaintances and friends of a sort. They knew each other. There were a lot of sort of conventions of abolitionists and conventions with black people that sometimes Tubman attended and more often Douglass attended. When it came time when, during Tubman's lifetime, a woman wrote a book about her life based on conversations with her. And, you know, I have quotes from the back of a book jacket about how this book is going to be great and all that. In the modern day, they did a version of that inside the book back in those days. And Frederick Douglass wrote an incredible letter of reference for Harriet Tubman, in which he compares and contrasts how he got to stand up in pulpits and on stages and publish newspapers and do everything in public light and kind of a safe atmosphere while she was out in the middle of nowhere with no one to help her and nothing to do. and no options except to count on the good graces of God with these poor people carrying her hands, and how she has no greater admirer in the world than he does. It was basically the greatest letter of reference I've ever read.
Because I should mention, by the way, that Douglas was extremely literate and wrote well. Of course, she was illiterate.
She was illiterate throughout her life.
Yeah, but this is a real contrast.
All the way to the end. It really is.
So, by the way, I can't let you go. Samuel Green. Tell me, he spent some time in prison.
Yes.
Reading with a copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin, which apparently then he went and spent some time with in terms of prison and that kind of thing. And one would think that, as we look back from this vantage point, owning a book or possessing a book like that would not necessarily be something that you would necessarily go to jail for. But at the time...
Yeah. So Reverend Samuel Green was born into slavery around East New Market. He grew up to become a lay minister in his church. It's a congregation that actually still meets in East New Market. There's a marker outside of the church at Railroad Avenue as you drive through East New Market on the highway. It's off to the right behind the railroad tracks. He had two sons. He and his wife had two children. I'm sorry, a son and a daughter. And he was almost certainly a conductor on the Underground Railroad who helped people escape. His son escaped. So his son and his daughter, he eventually, his master willed him to freedom. And he was able to buy his wife's freedom. But the children remained enslaved, and they got moved into a house on High Street in Cambridge, where things did not go well. The son later recalled whippings and all kinds of horrible things happening in that house. That's where he ran from, the son, Sam Green Jr., and he ran to Canada, and he made it. And he wrote a letter back home to tell his parents that everything was okay. And his parents were also planning to go visit him, so they had various travel schedules to Canada and things like that. Reverend Green had a wonderful description of what it was, the decision that his son made in trying to escape. He said he prayed with his legs. I titled the chapter about this, "The Price of Freedom." Because Sam Green Jr. paid a real price for running away. His sister was sold off. She was married and had children, was sold off by herself to Missouri and never heard from again. His father was arrested for being an activist on the Underground Railroad, but they didn't really find very much evidence against him. But they did find that letter that Sam Jr. wrote, and they found some train schedules to Canada. And as you mentioned, they found a copy of a bestseller at the time, Uncle Tom's Cabin, by Harriet Beecher Stowe. He ended up being sentenced to 10 years in prison in Baltimore. So their life was torn apart as well. This was a big cause célèbre at the time. All the abolitionists in the North were trying to get clemency for Sam Green Jr. because he was in prison basically for owning a book that everybody in the North had in their homes. Eventually did, after five-ish years, the Maryland governor released him from prison on the condition that he leave Maryland and never set foot again. On his journey to the North, where he's flat broken, has some health issues, he starts giving speeches in some churches and things. During his stop in New York City, he actually got the opportunity to meet Harriet Beecher Stowe. And she later wrote in a newspaper column, this subject, that subject, another subject kind of newspaper columns, and down towards the bottom is like, I met this minister from Maryland who was in prison, spent 5 years in prison, she goes into what an ordeal that must have been, and then concludes, but he carried this. This was all his part of the cross, and he just carried it with him. The only thing he asked of me is if I could give him a copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin, because he never got a chance to actually read the book.
We were speaking with Jim Duffy. He's author of a new book, and it's entitled 32 Underground Railroad Journeys on Delmarva Tubman Travels. We appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us this morning.
Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC 14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.